Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is all about the future, and tonight we're going to be talking about past futures as well as weird futures. And so this is the audio version of the Speculous weblog, and join us at the Speculous at www.speculous.com. And I've got with me tonight Michael Darling, as well as Phil Bauermaster, who will be joining me in just a minute. But how are you tonight, Michael?
I am doing great. It's spring has sprung here in Colorado where I am, and it's a good thing.
You guys have a lot more winter than I have to experience, I think, most of the year. As a matter of fact, I don't hardly have winter at all here in Louisiana. But I mean, you've got a lawn to mow and everything else now, huh?
Yes, I've got the lawn to mow and the baseball games to play, and it's just spring here, but it's. I don't know. I think mentally I was just more ready for it this year than I have been in a long time. Normally the winters here don't bother me that much. I just don't care. But this winter I didn't like it. I wanted it over, and now it is.
Did you grow up in that area? Is Denver home to you?
I grew up in suburban Chicago.
Okay.
And then I went in the Air Force, and I lived in a lot of places. And my first winter after college, when I was in the Air Force, I was living in Sacramento. And the worst winter day in Sacramento is like, you know, opening day at Wrigley Field. I mean, it was sunny in 50s most of the time in the winter. And I'm like, this is the way winter should be.
Well, you know, we keep hearing about, you know, how global warming is going to be the future for us. And this year has not been especially warm, at least not in my area. I was even out camping earlier this weekend, camped out on Friday night, and man, I got cold. And I wouldn't expect that this time here.
I think global warming is a bad name, just because I think I'm skeptical that we fully understand the implications of a changing climate, and the fact that it might, on average, the world over, be a couple degrees warmer. I don't think it necessarily means that Louisiana, which is normally warmer than Colorado, is going to stay warmer than Colorado.
Yeah.
I just think it means the climate's going to change.
Yeah.
But I honestly don't know. I just think it's more complicated than we can accurately forecast.
Well, I think that's the key with forecasting future all around, is that it's more difficult than you can imagine. It's as difficult to forecast the future of, I don't know, television or this or that, as it is the weather. I mean, there's so many things that go into, you know, what we ought to expect for the future, that it's a little hard to get a handle on it.
And, I went to the University of Illinois, and there was like any university, there's lecture series ongoing all the time, and this was in the latter part of the 80s, and there was a big talk about climate change, global warming,
mm-hmm.
and not an especially informed individual sitting in the crowd of about 40 or 50 of us watching this atmospheric science guy talk about what was going to happen and what was happening and greenhouse gases and going through the whole story. This would have been, I don't know, probably the fall of 86.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy sitting there goes, well, if it's overall warmer, shouldn't we have more cloud cover in general? And won't that mitigate the warming effect? Long pause, lots of staring. It's like, yeah, that gets into an area where it's more complicated than we can accurately forecast. But the basic principle is the same. Greenhouse gases will lead to this impact. I'm like, yeah, the part about it being more complicated is the part that really stuck with me.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, I'm on now.
Oh, great. Welcome to the show, Phil. We were just talking about basically having to pull out the old lawnmowers again.
Oh, well, there you go. Now, this was the very topic I said I didn't want us to get bogged down in.
Well, we hadn't gotten too bogged down.
I had mentioned that before the podcast started that I was out thatching my my lawn, doing the power rake this afternoon. So I feel like this is my first time using the lawnmower in the new address, and you know, you really feel like you live someplace once you start doing that kind of stuff. So
speaking of past futures, I have a theory that I don't have any hard data to back up. I have two examples with which to back up, and it's the theory has to do with why we even have grass lawns in the first place.
Okay.
I think
so this is a weird future where people have grass lawns. Is that what you're saying?
I am aware that people have grass lawns. I'm not aware why.
Well,
of all the things you could plant, I think low maintenance would be one of the first things you'd pick as a characteristic. But grass, and especially in this part of the world, is anything but low maintenance.
You know, there's actually somewhere I read one of the founding fathers might have been Benjamin Franklin, because he always had something to say about it, everything. You know, the guy that I was reading, and it probably was Benjamin Franklin, was coming out in favor of basically letting your lawn be whatever it's going to be. You know, wildflowers here. You know,
but nowadays we call that xeriscape.
Yeah,
Franklin was way ahead of his time.
That's right. That's what.
Or we call it the bum neighbor who doesn't water. I actually
exactly.
We call
serious,
it weeds is another.
Yeah, we call it weeds. That's right. The land ownership pattern that we have basically comes out of the next phase post monarchy from European and especially the English system, where if you had a landed title, you owned everything that went with that title, and then you could parcel it out to tenants and so forth. Now we have a more complicated system of private property where, yeah, it doesn't matter your title. If you could step up and qualify for the mortgage, not to deviate onto that subject, but you get to own a piece of the thing, and then you get to do what you want with it up to a point. But when it was back in the titled thing, the guy who parceled it out was, like, charged with, I mean, he literally owned everything. He owned all the animals. He owned the birds. He owned the water that ran through it. He owned everything. And so the goal was make it productive. And yet you waste this huge lawn. Why?
Oh, the answer is in the question, okay?
There you go.
We have inherited the property law model of land ownership, and we are also emulating what they did on their estates.
That's right.
That's where lawns got their start, right?
They did the lawn. To prove how much land they could waste.
Yeah.
They did the lawn because they wanted to, you know, lawn bowl and play badminton and things like that. They wanted to prove, A, we could waste all this land just having beautiful green grass, and B, you had all these
you had all this staff and folks hanging around the compound in the castle. You had to keep them busy. And as we all know, no better way to keep them busy than by tending the lawn, because it's never-ending.
Well, we're going to get off the lawn now.
this was my nightmare scenario, that we talk about grass all night.
Well, we're not going to do it.
I would have predicted, and I'll predict now, that the day is coming where we're going to get rid of these maintenance-intensive turf lawns.
Let's get on to the past futures. I want to play for the audience this audio that I found about the General Motors 1939 Futurama exhibit. Now, this is part of the New York World's Fair. And what's cool about it is to listen and hear what they got right and to hear what they got wrong. And so I'm just going to play. This is just a small excerpt from it.
At last, you entered the General Motors Futurama through a narrow cleft in that high wall. And you were put into a moving chair, and a voice began to speak with calm certainty. And before you opened a wonderland, 3,000 square miles in scale, a plane ride over an America from which the past, my present, had vanished, seemingly without a trace.
And now we see a great river city of 1960. Here is an American city replanned around a highly developed modern traffic system. On all express city thoroughfares, the rights of way have been so rooted as to displace outmoded business sections, and undesirable slum areas whenever possible. A vast circular airport is close to the city, with a giant dirigible hangar, so that it can be turned easily to meet any wind direction. It is resting in a pool of liquid. Here is a highway intersection. Highway engineering at its most spectacular. By means of the ramped loops, cars may make right and left turns at rates of speed up to 50 miles per hour.
Whoa.
Safe distance between cars is maintained by automatic radio control. Curved sides assist the driver in keeping his car within the proper lane under all circumstances. A quarter of a mile high, skyscrapers tower. On many of the buildings are landing decks for helicopters and autogyros. We see some suggestion of the things to come. A world with a future in which all of us are tremendously interested. Because that is where we are going to spend most of our lives.
It was Democracy and Greenbelt all stitched together with the superhighways General Motors was counting on. And whether or not the Futurama was exactly what the social planners had in mind for America, General Motors had no doubts. When you left the building, you were given a small blue and white button that said simply, "I have seen the future."
Okay, well, that was amazing.
Well, it was amazing in a couple of ways, Phil. The things that I found interesting about it was the fact that they got the highways right.
Right. 50 miles an hour. Ooh.
Yeah, you could exit at full speed, which, I mean, that, you know, if you're sitting there in 1939 and every road you've ever been to where there's an intersection, you have to stop and then you have to turn. And
right.
That was revolutionary at the time. You know, things they got wrong, like the airports that are on water that can be turned, and the dirigibles. You know, that was out of the picture very quickly after 1939. That was really already on its way out at that point. And you know, one thing I did notice about that, this was probably one of the last future exhibits there was in the world where computers were not on display or are really prominently part of what they consider to be the future.
That's interesting. I'm sure they talked about radio and talked about television, right?
Right.
But not computers.
Yeah. And
that was 1939, yeah.
And they talked a lot about television. So.
Well, I love the idea of autogyros. You know you're dealing with a past future when you hear about dirigibles or autogyros.
That's right. I have a hope that both will make a comeback, but that's been 50 years that they've been talking about making it.
I think the dirigible has found its usefulness in the Goodyear blimp.
That's about it. Yeah.
And I don't know, the autogyro is just probably not a great idea, I guess, at the end of the day. It's just, you know, it's got too many, like, the drawbacks of the helicopter without the advantages. I don't know. It just never seemed to have caught on. But a lot of it sounds like Sky Captain and The World of Tomorrow, that movie.
That's right.
They worked a lot of those elements into there. And people were convinced that the future was going to include this this kind of technology. You know, there are hooks or moorings or rings or something on the Empire State Building for tying dirigibles to it.
Yeah,
and there was the thought that, you know, that's how it's going to be in the future. These skyscrapers will have airships landing, hooking up to them. People will walk right into the skyscraper from the it's a wonderful vision of the future. It would have been a weird future, but a neat one. But we seem to have.
Of course, they opened up the Sky Captain movie with that exact scene, didn't they?
That's right.
Yeah. So, Yeah, that's a pretty it's a pretty neat future that almost was. I think that, you know, if things gone a little bit different, had there not been a Hindenburg disaster, had we been able to make the transition from hydrogen to helium more smoothly, then, you know, perhaps we would have seen those things. But oh well.
Possibly.
Airplanes took
radio off. On Blog Talk Radio Network. And we're talking about weird futures. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 347-215-8972 and tell us about your own weird ideas about the future. So what other past futures do we have? Does anyone have any other examples of weird futures that never came about? Because I've got at least one.
I'm going to let you kick it off, Phil.
Yeah, dingle that out there, and then I better pretty much...
There you go.
I was actually talking to my wife about this the other day, and this is kind of the quintessential bad prediction of the future. And I don't know if it's apocryphal or if it's a true story, but a city planner in New York in the 19th century wrote a paper warning full of dire predictions as to what the environmental impact of population growth of the city was going to be. And his biggest concern was what? Do you guys know? Have you heard this one?
Let me throw out
horse poop.
Yeah.
Horse manure is absolutely right. Yes, he made predictions that by the year 1940 or so, the city would be up to like the third story of three-story buildings with horse manure. And that would have been a very weird and very dismal future, but that's a past future. It's an incorrect prediction of the future because he just, you know, he didn't see the automobile coming. So that's
Well, and he also sort of discounted, I think, rather significantly the effort to clean it away. I mean, there would have been a big pile of it somewhere, but it wouldn't have been in the streets of New York City.
Well, clearly it wouldn't have been in the streets of New York City, but somewhere there would have been a huge pile of manure. Yeah, it makes it more dramatic if you keep it in Manhattan for for warning purposes,
yes,
right? But do we have other examples of past futures that never came about?
Well, you know, here's an example of something that... I mean, this, and I don't think this is apocryphal. I think this is factual, actually. Stocks in gas for gas lighting supposedly took a big dip when? I know you guys know this.
When, for gas lighting? Oh, when the light bulb was invented.
Well, no, before that.
Oh.
When it was announced that Edison was looking into finding a way to do electric lighting.
Oh, that's interesting.
He already had this reputation as this miracle worker, and gas stocks just plummeted when it was announced that he was going to do it. He just, of course, he spent years finding the right filament. So,
right. Yeah. So it took several years for that to really kick in.
Well, there's another example there of where he got it wrong because he thought that every neighborhood, every block, every little would be clustered around one generator. Instead of he didn't envision this gigantic grid, and yet we end up with this gigantic grid, and we end up with one power plant powering the whole metro area. He got that part wrong.
Yeah,
there's a past future. So we live in this weird future from Edison's standpoint, where everybody's hooked up to this huge electric grid.
Well, and I think he probably also envisioned that. Most people would be pretty aware of the fact that the power for their little node came from someplace close by because they'd all be wired into it.
Right.
But in fact, I'd be willing to bet 8 in 10 Americans really don't have a pretty good idea where the electricity comes from other than the outlet in the wall. I mean, they just –
well,
there's
and,
no
– and there's no – and no one really knows. I mean, even an expert, if you're just plugged into the grid – I mean, the
right.
power could be coming from anywhere.
Right.
Any electric plant in the United States that's on the grid could be sending the electron to your computer at any particular time. It's, you know, it is a pretty interesting way of doing it.
So we tap into this amazing power source, and we don't even know where it's coming from.
Yep.
That's a pretty weird future when you think of it. It's like the internet, right? All these different machines are holding this vast network of information. You don't really know where it is. It's kind of located across a whole lot of different nodes, right?
Right.
That's a weird future.
Absolutely. I mean, as far as stuff that is going to happen, I mean, you can't get too much weirder than the singularity itself. I mean, as far as the stuff that's going to, you know, that could occur in the future. I think something that Michael mentioned a couple of weeks ago, fusion power. You know, if that ever comes online, that's going to change the world in ways that we can't even imagine.
That will change the world in ways we cannot imagine. I mean, it gives us big. What we think about is abundant energy, so energy will cost less, and we can, leave the lights burning, or you know, I mean, what's the big advantage to abundant energy? But it's suddenly when you plug in all that extra energy, people will find things to do with it that they've never found before, and then the world starts to be transformed in ways that, as you said, who knows what that'll look like.
Right.
My prediction there would be that rather than just say, hey, we're at the consumption level we're at now for electricity, and now we can do it so much more efficiently, isn't that great? We would just have access to so much more power, we'd just use it all.
Yeah.
And
that's
and
a measure of the
advantage.
I'm sorry.
I give the American automotive market, as enhancements come along that could if they so desired, say, you know, that top speed of 50 miles an hour that we had in 1939 or 1960 or whatever, that's fine. Let's take advancements that come along and just make the vehicles more efficient. No. We took the efficiency from 1960 and said, that efficiency is fine, 10, 12, 14 miles a gallon, that's all we need. And every improvement that came along, we plowed it into more power.
For a while.
So now we have the 260 horsepower, 0 to 60 in, 6 seconds, car that any consumer can go and buy. It's like, yeah, we got more power. Let's just make it more powerful. Who cares about efficiency?
You know what the analogy to that is? I remember when I bought my first Macintosh for my home, and it was a big deal that this thing had a huge 40 megabyte hard disk.
Yeah.
And you know, today I wouldn't even I would be unhappy with a mere 40 gigabyte hard disk, right?
Yeah.
I'd want 1,000 times more isn't enough. I need, 2,000 or 3,000 times more to make
you can't. You couldn't survive on 40 megs of RAM.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. You think, wow, these computers in the future are going to be so huge. Think of all the great stuff we'll be able to do. It's like, yeah, but now it's like you need gigabytes to run Microsoft Word. it used to run on a floppy on a 128K Mac, but now it takes gigabytes to run. So I think there's there is a tendency for us to take our activity and let capability that we have today expand into the resource pool of the future, so that sometimes the amazing stuff doesn't show up quite the way we were hoping it would, because Microsoft Word really hasn't gotten all that amazing. I mean.
For what it is, it is amazing, but you're right. The fact that the or any word processing program went from what we used to be able to do on our old machines, which for my purposes was perfectly adequate, now the machine is way more powerful, and it has to be to run the program, and the word processing experience is still, perfectly adequate. I don't find it mind-boggling.
Yeah. Certainly not 1,000 times more interesting. That's for sure.
That's right.
But we're looking for those things that will be more interesting. So let's talk about some other kinds of futures. How about a weird entertainment future? What weird things might people do for entertainment in the future, or what things in the past have people said that might become interesting forms of entertainment in the future?
Well, let me bring up Soylent Green again. not from the as their people. You got to tell them it's people. But you remember in that movie, this rich guy who could afford to actually eat steak every now and then, imagine that. They had within his home, I think, probably the first example of a upright video game, arcade game cabinet, probably ever. And if you remember, he had, the girl that came with the apartment, she was basically furniture. She was sitting there playing that video game in that movie. You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a past future idea about a video game.
That, exactly, and it preceded actual arcade game cabinets probably by 5 to 10 years, and then the arcade cabinets looked very much like what you saw in that movie. But you know, the arcade cabinets like that have never really migrated into the homes, not to any great extent. I suppose a few rich people may have.
Because you don't need it.
No, you don't.
You could hook the hardware up to your TV, and it, you know, you could play 6 dozen, you know, hundreds of different games on your TV. Even back in the '70s, they had that capability that you could play dozens of different games on your TV. So why would you buy a cabinet, really?
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. So,
you know, because you've already got a TV that you can.
Because it looks cool.
Yeah,
it does look cool.
That's
collectors, so, people with a certain amount of money will buy a cabinet.
Probably. So instead of doing that, let's extrapolate on that into the real, you know, into what we think will be the future. Instead of it looking like the like an arcade game cabinet that probably people won't do, what will our video game experience at home be like in 10 years or 20 years?
Here's what I would hope, and I'll use as my example a flight simulator. If you just said, hey, I want to pretend to fly a 747 from Denver, Colorado to Los Angeles and land at LAX, that you would be able to have both the imagery and the ability to project it in a way that, from a simulation point of view, it's, if not realistic, it's compelling. Now, I use that as an example only because I like flying and I used to fly, and I think if you can pull off the flight simulator, you can do all kinds of cool things. You could, you know, in that same environment, you could create a vehicle that would allow you to simulate scuba diving. But you do it in your living room.
You're just wearing goggles? You're what?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's the VR model where it's a goggle or an implant, or maybe it's you know, the big screens all around the room and a handful of projectors. I don't know. I'm just...
Well, in 10 years, it might be something like... In 10 years, it might be where you... You know, there's certain video games where you're actually moving and you know, they have an omnidirectional treadmill now that allows you to walk in any direction. And the whole idea is that, you could use that in a virtual reality setting. That'd be pretty cool. The next step after that is where you actually jack in, where you would experience all the sensations of swimming and everything else in a virtual reality world. And
you think about a fourth or fifth generation Wii, it would have swimming.
Exactly.
And the interface is straight into your nervous system, and you set the current, you know, the depth. You put the pool someplace interesting, you know, you put interesting people around you, and then you start swimming. And you're actually having you feel like you're physiologically having the experience of swimming, but would you get any exercise doing that? Would that be a real experience? Or what would be happening physically while your body is experiencing that?
It'd probably be much like a dream. You'd have to be disconnected from your nervous system, more or less. You know,
you're just flailing, right?
Exactly, and that's basically what you do when you're dreaming. You know, when you're walking around in your dream, you for the most part you're not walking, you're not moving. You're laying there in your bed.
Right.
Well,
go ahead, Michael.
The swimming model, you would, you could definitely get exercise. I mean, I've played Wii and I've seen other people play Wii, and you will get out of breath. You know, you're moving. But in swimming, there's this fear factor where if you don't breathe at the right intervals, it's bad. And I can't imagine how you would even attempt or want to build a game that you could actually drown. So you wouldn't. You just say, well, your character is going to drown, your avatar is going to drown, and you go, okay, it's a little bit different, you know, motivation. But maybe you could make that work. You could be attached to your avatar in a way that, whether it's fear or whatever, you'd be motivated enough, and you'd get the a similar kind of exercise. Huh.
Interesting thought. Yeah, I don't think really drowning would be a good idea.
Yeah. We're all in agreement.
Have issues galore for Nintendo around having... Yeah, but any of those kinds of high-risk things, you know, when the skateboard video game really actually includes the sensation of skateboarding, clearly you don't want to have it include the physical consequences of falling over, you know, landing on your head
right.
and stuff like that.
Right.
But it's interesting that you mentioned dreaming, because we talked about that in a Better All the Time a few weeks ago. Actually, the beginnings of research into recording and being able to play back and being able to tap into people's dreams. And I see this as one of the major entertainment channels of, I don't know whether it'll be 2 decades from now, 3 decades from now, but when they can give you dreams, when you can pick your own dreams and say, I want to have a dream about this, right? It'll have these characters in it, and I'll have these capabilities, and I'm going to be this person doing these things. I think that'll be huge. I think that that dreaming might actually become our number one form of entertainment, because anything's possible when
yeah.
you're dreaming.
Yeah, I would suggest to you that virtual reality would be much the same, and perhaps could be doing that in a semi-awake state. I don't know. The line between virtual reality and a programmed dream might be really, really fuzzy.
Yeah, in fact, we
might be the same thing.
Yeah, we might be making a distinction without a difference here. By the time it shows up, it could be exactly the same thing.
Yeah, no doubt.
I think in that model, I would choose at least once in a while, and perhaps most of the time, I would choose to have a dream that I myself would never think of. I mean, all the characters in my dream speak English.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought, Michael. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We are talking about the future. We're talking about weird futures, and we're just about to get into what are the strange dreams that Michael's never had. So if you'd like to join us in talking about that, give us a call at 347-215-8972. So what would go into a dream that you've never had before?
Well, for example, the characters wouldn't all speak English. In my dreams, they do, because that's all I speak.
Well, would your dream be closed captioned?
would you speak the other language too? Or
I'm just saying, if it's going to be the dream I myself wouldn't have, it's got to be something I couldn't think of. It's like, give me a human rendering of some situation or context that I myself would never have thought of.
Hmm. Surprise me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blow my head, you know, explode me.
Yeah. Well, okay. Again, this is something I would want to avoid. It's sort of like drowning.
I mean, metaphorically, in a dramatic, literary sense.
Okay, you didn't mean literally.
Not scanners.
Not at this point, although I reserve the right to change that in the future.
Well, that is the interesting dilemma of both program dreaming and virtual reality, of entertainment where anything is possible. Once you've experienced it a few times, you know, if you can program the dream, right, and you know it's whatever that you've got. You know, that you're a bazillionaire and you're, you know, married to Gisele Bündchen and, you know, whatever it is. I mean, that once you go through it 5 or 6 times, maybe that starts to get boring. So you have to spice it up with, I've never been run over by a car. I wonder what that feels like, right? And it's possible. And this would be a very weird future indeed, where because people have entertainment that enables them to experience just about anything, they do end up experiencing just about anything. They're trying the scanners thing and everything else just to see what it would feel like.
Even very unpleasant things. Hmm.
Yeah, especially those because those you know there's like this endless variety of those, right?
Without physical consequence, you know, as soon as it's over, it's
right.
over. Hmm.
Right. As long as you can you stay safe, so you would do things. And you know, this goes back to a subject that we touched on last week where I made the claim that ethics are contextual. I think people would do things that they would never, or we would hope they would never do in their real life, but they would do it in the dream because they're like, yeah, I want to see it, I want to feel it.
Well, as it is, things happen in our dreams that, you know, we do things in our dreams that we would never do in real life, and things occur to us.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah. In video games, for example, I mean, you know, you don't think of anything of logging on and blowing away a couple hundred people in you know, in Quake or whatever, Doom. It's, you know, we play these very violent video games, and, you know, periodically you'll hear people, you know, say that this is just going to result in all, you know, the kids growing up really violent or whatever. And so far it hadn't played out that way. And so, yeah.
That's true. So hopefully, even if people go to extremes in their dreams or in their virtual reality, that's not going to translate back into the real world.
Well, we hope
not. And that would just be crazy anyway, because, you know, what are you going to get hooked on getting run over by a car and so decide you're going to try it in the, you know? I mean,
if you're sick enough, maybe you could, but.
Well, this goes to the fact that as a species, maybe the evolutionary impulse is ultimately destructive.
Yeah, I don't know. That would not be my first choice for a virtual reality experience. I tell you that. I think I would enjoy a lot of sitting on the beach. Or followed immediately by being on the mountain snow skiing or something, you know.
Well, yeah, I think some pleasant things. I think I could enjoy a lot of really nice things before I would get bored with them and started, throwing myself off the cliff or
yeah.
Something like that. Well, I think about Second Life. You give me a full immersion version of Second Life, and I'll be very happy there for quite some time just because you go, you know, any place you want to go, you can fly. You can fly under your own power.
Yeah,
and that will be a very cool thing in virtual reality, which is to be experiencing what feels like real life, and yet have that added dimension of, oh, I need to get over there. Here goes, I'm up, you know, I'm off the ground, I'm flying under my own power like Superman. I think, you know, I might get bored with that eventually, but I would certainly enjoy it for a while. I think I would enjoy it for a good long while.
All
so
right.
What are some other weird futures? How about weird food futures? I observed that this week that we live in a weird food future. I had posted a blog entry from an ad from Pizza Hut that I got via email, and I felt like I had to share that with the world. Pizza Hut now selling pasta, and they were touting the excellent quality of their pasta, so good that they dared to describe it as restaurant quality pasta.
From Pizza Hut.
Yes, from Pizza Hut. So, to me, this is just the, it just so bizarre. You know, what a strange world we live in that a restaurant would boast that they're producing restaurant quality pasta.
I guess probably what they were thinking, Phil, is, you know, you can have restaurant food in your home. We'll bring it to you. I guess that maybe that's what they were saying with that ad. But yeah, I laughed at the ad too. It was pretty funny.
Yeah, I think that's probably what they meant. But
it didn't come out like that, did it? It didn't come.
It seemed like they were setting the bar a little lower than maybe they. They should have been trying. I read that and I went, whatever happened to trying to make it like as good as homemade or something? You know, I mean.
Well, maybe homemade's not as good as it used to be. I think we may have lost some of our skills in the kitchen, the average American.
That's true. But it seems like, you know, tonight, guys, I want us to really put our best effort in and make this just a podcast quality program.
No doubt. At least that good.
Yeah, we're shooting straight for the middle, and I really think we got a shot at it. I really do. Actually, you know, I looked at that because I work in marketing, and my theory on that one is that whoever came up with that tagline is very high in the organization.
Yeah, high enough that nobody can criticize them. Or
yeah, I think so. You know, I think that somebody way up there, the head marketing guy or the CEO or somebody said, hey, I got it, restaurant quality pasta, and nobody could argue with it.
Well, here's another take, and you put it into perspective. It hadn't occurred to me. When I saw it, I'm reminded that they're running these commercials on TV now where they're at what appears to be, you know, some very upscale, happening, hip restaurant in Manhattan, and the chef is walking around asking everybody how they like their pasta, and they're saying, oh, it's awesome. And then here comes the big reveal, and all the Pizza Hut delivery guy comes in, and the chef's like, yeah, I didn't do anything tonight. It was all Pizza Hut. So maybe the restaurant quality food, the real implication in here is that what they mean is great restaurant food, And, you know, we know that's not Pizza Hut. So, in fact, they are setting the bar a little bit higher for themselves, but only by implication.
Yeah. I think that it probably means something very much like that. that they're really, you know, that they're really saying Pizza Hut delivery. We all know that's not like going to a good Italian restaurant, and not what they're offering would be that level. I think that.
Well, see, but I think your argument. This is funny too, because the claim they could have made then is better than you can make yourself.
Right. You know, that's another possibility for sure.
It's just better only because they made it. Now you don't have to, and that's better because, you know, you didn't have to lift a finger.
Right. Well, that gets me thinking, though, about, you know, what are some other weird food futures, both past futures and current? We talked about I'm getting a message from Stephen to call back in.
You're on.
Yeah.
I hear you.
Yeah, well, I hear you, but does the world hear us?
That's a good question.
Hmm.
Let's check the
chat room.
Check the chat.
Folks in the chat room, who do you hear? Us or Stephen? He had to jump out and come back on.
All right, we're lost. I'm going to call back in.
Okay.
Okay, are we back on air?
I'm here.
Okay, Michael, thanks for calling back in. We have a bit of a mess up there. The switchboard just went dead for a second. We were bragging about podcast quality audio there, and we lost the show altogether. Oh, well. Maybe we should have set the bar a little bit lower instead of having podcast quality.
You should put your mass-market consumer soda beverage right on the control panel.
Hey, I think we got Phil back, too.
I am here. Hello.
Okay, we're all back on, Phil.
This has been a weird show tonight.
It has been a very odd show. We lost audio there for about a minute and a half or so. I said that's what we get for saying we're going to have a podcast
level quality show. Yeah. We reach for the stars. You know, that's what happens when you reach for the stars. Sometimes you can't make it. So Michael and I were having this great chat that no one could hear about weird food futures. Having left restaurant quality pasta behind, and we were talking about what some of the other possibilities for that might be. One of which is what we talked about last week. The vat meat is a weird food future for sure. Certainly one that I think will probably happen, but one that sounds strange to people.
It'd be pretty gross at first, I would imagine, and something that. Most people won't do it first, and then it'll get better over time. I would just imagine.
It's going to be really gross at first, and it will, and the quality will improve. I think there's almost no question about that. Now, one of the food futures I used to hear about when I was a kid, back, you know, like in the 60s and 70s, you'd always hear these, like, you know, by the year 2000, these kinds of predictions that they would make about the future. One of them was, do you remember this one, that you'd just take a pill, and then that's all you would need, right?
I think the idea was based on, you know, what the astronauts were doing, you know.
Right. Right.
just because the astronauts were eating freeze-dried food on the way to the moon doesn't mean that that's what we would want to do.
Well, yeah, I don't think we would. And I certainly, the idea that even if there was a pill you could take that would then take care of all your nutritional needs, you know, eating is fun. I mean, you know, would you really want to just totally give that up in favor of
sometimes
in favor of taking a pill? And yet, Michael suggested an idea before the program started that runs along a similar vein. So outline your weird food future for us, Michael.
Well, first, let me just say that sometimes I would take the pill for sure. Long car trip. Who wants to stop? You take. Yeah, you do it. The weird food future I see is that we get to a point where we can put chlorophyll right in our skin and take the product and put it right into our metabolism. And, yeah, okay, so the side effect is you're green. So?
So you'll be green, but that means that whenever you get hungry, just get out and get some sun.
And ladies, that's not going to, that won't make you less attractive. Captain Kirk has already demonstrated that. He'll be attracted to green women. Yeah, so
that's where clothes come in. Now, if you could do it in a suit, you know, the big lycra stretchy suit that we all were supposed to be wearing by now, you'd put it on and take it off. But I don't know how you'd interface that to your metabolism. The chlorophyll right to the metabolism. I think the chlorophyll is in your skin, and we figure out a way to do that. And you'd see people going, "Yeah, I'll go green. Now I don't need food. I just need the sun and some water." Some potassium.
You know, I think the food future, I think that we may see in this country, if virtual reality is completely realistic, is that within our virtual world, we get to eat anything we want to, and we get to, you know, just pig out. And then in the real world, we eat modestly so as to not be fat. So we get that way you can enjoy both.
Right. Well, one of the other futures that has been touted is the one where you can eat anything you want and you'd always weigh the same. And various approaches for how that might be accomplished have been suggested, but certainly virtual reality is the easiest way to make that happen, because you're not actually eating anything, right? So you don't have to do anything weird with your metabolism or any of that kind of stuff.
The food products where there's zero calorie, zero nutritional content, zero, like, physiological impact always strike me as very odd. And there are products out there, whether they're drinks or they're, you know, potato chips made out of some weird thing, and the idea is that, hey, they have no calories and there's no food in them. You just get eat them and, you know, they're nothing. I'm like, it's all about flavor, the process of eating, but still that strikes me as very, very weird as a food future.
Well, and it strikes your body weird, too.
Yeah.
Like a lesson.
Yeah, read the fine print. May cause digestive difficulty.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, even there's...
gurgling and other
And by may, they mean it's going to.
Yeah.
There are carbonated diet beverages that have no calories and essentially no food content.
Yeah.
But they still taste good.
Well, that's
they don't have the same problem with
that's just flavored water. You know, I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Give me a convincing piece of cheesecake that has absolutely no calories. You know, and I bet that thing will mess you up somehow, right? I mean,
that's right.
And the more convincing it is, the more it's going to mess you up. That's my thought on it. On the cheesecake. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about weird futures. We've kind of got stuck on weird food futures because it's so much fun, but we got a few other topics. If you've got a weird future you'd like to share with us, give us a call at 347-215-8972. Hey, guys, I'm thinking since we've had a few technical difficulties, maybe we'll push on and do an extra 15 minutes this evening.
Sounds good to me.
We have so many weird futures to
There you go again, setting the bar high.
That's right.
I'll tell you what. We'll go an extra 15 minutes, or we'll stop the next time Stephen gets kicked out of the switchboard.
That switchboard just went dead. I don't know. I've never seen that's never happened before, unfortunately. And we were able to get it this reestablished. I'm thankful for that.
Well, you know, you have to. You talk about a weird future. Think about what we're doing here. Think about explaining this idea to yourself 10 years ago, right? Well, it's kind of like we have this radio show. It's these,
but not. It's, you know,
it's not really on the radio. It's kind of on a computer network. But basically, we've had very few problems with Blog Talk Radio. This is one of our second or third glitches that we've had with them along the way. So I think overall...
We shouldn't complain too much.
Not going to complain too much, although we do want to find that February 17th episode, if anyone's listening. We would select get that back if it's still sitting on a server someplace.
That's the one where Phil Spector logged into the chat room, and Phil Spector causes temporal disturbances everywhere he goes.
Explain that. I didn't quite get that.
Okay, I'm living in a weird future. Say again, Michael, what's it mean?
I can't explain it. I just wanted to say something funny about that February 17th episode being lost. Phil Spector was the first character that came to mind.
Oh, okay.
Although it does remind me that on the blog, there's the post about something and something, and then here comes HR Puffin stuff. I was like, what?
Well, we don't want to have to get into explaining
that.
That
was a logical progression. Okay, let me talk you through that one real fast. Okay, for those listening, please bear with us. This is actually worthwhile. So, Stephen, in fact, this relates to our human destiny ET, are they out there discussion that we were going to have in a few seconds. We can skip to that now, actually.
Okay, that's a good time to.
So, Stephen, you had go ahead and talk about your post.
Well, I basically had said that I'm an ET skeptic. I believe that we're probably alone in this galaxy, which is different from saying we're alone in the universe. Obviously, there's many, many, many galaxies, but in this galaxy, my thought is that we're probably alone because as old as the galaxy is, and if a life were to arise on a fairly regular basis, then the chances of us being the very first are very minimal, and we shouldn't. And I put in the post that we shouldn't be able to swing a cat without hitting a Vulcan, or at least the Vulcan's robotic emissary. And by that I mean, the von Neumann probes.
Right.
That should have reached us by now. So that was my basic thought. But that sort of explains away the Fermi paradox. And that Fermi paradox is, if there's really intelligent life throughout the galaxy, then where is everybody? Why are we alone?
So the notion is having to do with evolution, that life actually showed up very late on this planet. Is that right? Or
that's right. That's right.
And late in our
I quoted a scientist that basically said, okay, it appears that that this planet Earth has been capable of supporting life for about 4 billion years, and looks like there's only about 1 billion years left. And because in about 1 billion years, the sun will start to get hotter, and to the point that this planet will not sustain life. So the fact that although we only have, Michael, you pointed this out, we only have one example of intelligent life in the universe that we know of. We still can extrapolate something from this because we showed up late in this planet's lifetime, and because we showed up late, that tends to show that our showing up at all, our intelligent life showing up at all, is rather improbable, and that's what that scientist was saying. And so, and
especially
if we
showed up late, but actually early for intelligence, then
yeah.
It could just be that the window for getting intelligence is longer than the window that a typical planet would have to produce it, and if that's the case, then intelligence normally doesn't show up, and we're all alone in the universe. That's
one way we'd be anomalous.
Yeah.
You'd have other possibilities to be anomalous. That's a good one, though. We're not late. We're earlier than most other intelligences have been, but they came so late, by the time they started getting any intelligence, their atmosphere burned off, and they were gone.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and there are some other explanations, too, but before we go there, let me get you to
that's right.
So,
I'm waiting.
So I responded to that. I said, well, one of the things that has to happen, at least in the history of Earth, for the kind of intelligence that produces civilization, is that you need to develop a level of complexity without one of these extinction level events occurring. So life would develop to a certain point, then a big extinction-level event would occur, and then it had to kind of start from scratch. And one of the ideas that's been proposed is that the dinosaurs were actually heading towards where maybe we are now, and that they were going in, the brains were getting bigger, they were going bipedal in their getting around, kind of working towards hands and some of that kind of stuff. And the thinking was, hey, maybe eventually dinosaurs would evolve into some kind of roughly humanoid, roughly human intelligence species that would occupy essentially the same place that we occupy today. So I referenced that, and I sent a link to a picture of one of these biped dinosaurs, and the direction it may have evolved, and where it evolved to was this, humanoid dinosaur. And Stephen responded to that with,
yep, and then a link. And, of course, the link went to SleaStacks. Okay.
I saw the link to the flea stacks. And okay. I thought that, okay, now.
Okay, and now the flea stacks
are everything.
Also, it was Sid and Marty Krofft production. So I said, yes, those guys were way ahead of their time, but I don't know what evolutionary dead end they had in mind when they came up with this guy. And then I looked for
okay.
All right.
Now so the crazy. HR Puffin Stuff circle is complete.
All my jokes take this lengthy of an explanation, actually, but it's so worthwhile. I'm sure everyone's listening.
Harvey asks about Chaka in the chat room.
Chaka, you know, the what were they called? The those guys.
It starts with a P, didn't it? Like a Pecoy or something like that. But anyway, obviously they were like some sort of early hominid that was like real short hominid kind of caveman creatures.
Chaka couldn't speak though, could he?
They actually invented a language for those animals, people or whatever they were.
Chaka spoke a kind of a pidgin English, you know.
Yeah.
He couldn't get pronouns down. He was always Chaka do this, Chaka do that. He had the kind of Tarzan Tonto kind of approach to language, but he could talk. Okay, so let's not lose the thread here though, which is what we're talking about is weird futures. And
well, you know, I think that there's another explanation for the Fermi paradox, and Phil, you've voiced it a couple of times when I've brought up that in the past that I'm sort of an ET skeptic,
right?
That there's another explanation for what is happening to ET and why ET hadn't shown up.
I think there's a good explanation that doesn't require this idea that intelligence either can't develop or that it must fizzle out, and I think that. And this is actually an idea that I've gotten from John Smart from reading his stuff. But basically, intelligence gets on the same trajectory that we're on. And before too long, you hit the singularity, and then you're in a silicon substrate, and you're getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And what happens within a very short period of time, once you've reached technological development, once you've reached computers and have moved on into the singularity, is civilizations disappear. They move into inner space. They're down there working at the Planck scale or in femtospace or something like that. Then,
or they abandon the universe altogether somehow.
Or out of this universe altogether, and we just have no means of detecting them. And it could be that the term that John uses is destiny of species. It could be that our destiny is just to fade out of this universe and to know some completely other mode of existence.
Yeah.
Which is a more happy ending, I think, than
the other one. Yeah, well, the question is, can you take Puffin Stuff with you?
Yeah. You can take anything with you into that universe. But my thought is that, you know, it may not be that unhappy to be if you're the only one and then you branch out and fill this galaxy, for example. I mean, obviously, you know, and as you move out into the galaxy, the species would change, and you would end up with intelligences throughout the galaxy that would be as alien to us as if they had evolved in another place as they moved out into the universe. So, I mean, it doesn't. You know, you could still end up with a wide variety of.
We'd still not be alone.
We
could, you know.
By filling the galaxy, just us, yeah, I mean.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, you know, we're not alone. We got each other.
That's
right. Even if there's no aliens, we've still got other humans or whatever humans eventually evolve.
End up being. And if we can self-direct our own evolution, then, you know, some people are going to make choices very different from what I would make. And so you'd end up with the human race splintering in 1,000 directions.
So if the John Smart transcension makes sense, that the species gets through a singularity, the intelligence then says, hey, there's more interesting places to be than this universe, and off they go, and that explains the aloneness. It also implies that there's either no way or no motivation to reach backward. I mean, where's my breadcrumbs?
That's a good point. And maybe there's no way, or maybe there's no motivation. I would like to think that if we were in that position, we'd throw some kind of bone to the up-and-coming blobs of protoplasm out there.
We sent Voyager out into space with all sorts of interesting breadcrumbs.
Yeah. And why wouldn't at least one other intelligence, you know, John Smart's idea might be true of 999 out of 1,000, you know, civilizations. They might just all disappear with no trace. But, you know, where's the other one out of 1,000? You know, and why haven't they sent out the probes or whatever?
That's exactly my question. Maybe there's no way to reach back from the other universe, and maybe there's no reason to. But come on, man, we send what was the guy? Dark Was the Night by Blind Willie Johnson. We sent that into space on Voyager for gosh sakes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but you know, I mean, we really threw a needle into the biggest possible haystack. I mean,
yeah.
So there could be a few needles thrown into the haystack before species transcend.
I think if they're close to the transcension, they could, you know, make the needle.
They could do better than we did. Yeah, they could probably send out a better feature than we did.
Maybe they don't care anymore at that point, because at that point they recognize that their destiny is to go in, and that if it's meant to be for these other up and coming species, it will be, and if not, doesn't matter.
Interesting.
Huh.
I'm just throwing it out there. I don't know. I'm not one of these advanced species. Well, actually, we are potentially one of these advanced species.
It doesn't bode well for Chaka and Puff and stuff. That's all I got to say about that.
We're not one yet. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're down to our final 15 minutes of talking about weird futures, so this is your chance to share your ideas about a weird future with us. Give us a call at 347-215-8972. Okay, we've saved the best for last.
Well, before we do the best one, I had one other one I want to throw in, and it's not anywhere near the best one.
Okay, go.
I just want to throw in this. I think that we're going to have fewer and fewer languages and less language diversity, and it's going to happen a lot faster than anybody's thinking. It's not multiple generations away where everybody in the world speaks three languages. It's like the next generation or the generation after that. There may be a lot of bilingualism going on, but everybody's going to know one of the big three.
Yeah. And I predict we'll be cursing.
It seems to be going in that direction, yeah. I mean, that almost seems like just a rational projection from what we see happening.
I think we'll be speaking English and cursing, and then when we curse, we'll be doing it in Chinese. So.
Yeah, and we'll call the universe the verse for short.
That's right.
It'd be great. A weird future would be one where... instead, what happens is because we have increased intelligence and because we have increased capability of making use of other languages, there's an explosion of languages where not only currently existing languages are brought back, but people create whole new ones. And individuals, you know, a couple might have their own language that only they speak to each other because the technology will support that. And the whole notion of language is just in its infancy now, because it will grow into this much, much larger thing in the very near future. Now, that is a weird linguistic future.
I think that makes...
I'm sorry.
That is weird, and I like it.
And I think, you know, once you're smart enough, I mean, why not? You could learn every language there ever was if you're smart enough. And you know,
right, if you can improve your intelligence. One of the things I love, I think I've talked about this before in the book, Eon, Greg Bear's science fiction novel. A guy needs to learn Russian, and he takes a pill, and then he knows Russian. And I just think that is, you know, having had to try to learn Russian in my own life, you know, I'm not taking a pill instead of eating, but, man, taking a pill instead of learning a language, I would definitely be all over that.
Having tried to learn Russian, you're wondering, do you get to take a pill after so that you forget it?
Well, actually, you go to Russia, and they have a beverage you can drink there. Which
made from potatoes.
Yeah, well, exactly. Sometimes made from potatoes. Okay, so we're moving swiftly on now to the weirdest of all weird futures. Let's talk about the futures involving sex and relationships. So who's got a... We already talked about Captain Kirk and the green chick, right? That was back in the 60s. That was a weird future, the idea of having a relationship with this green alien woman. That was odd. But what kind of weird directions do you think humanity might be going?
Well, there's
human relationships are concerned.
Two possibilities, and they're probably not. Neither of them are mutually exclusive. Sex with robots and virtual reality sex.
Okay.
There's like a new book out by a guy that's like, you know, he's saying that, you know, Sex with Robots is just right around the corner. So there you go. There's that. But then I'm going to tell you that once it's possible for, you know, what will it mean to the world once it's possible for any schlub to get on, you know, the internet or get on enter a virtual reality world filled with beautiful women and you know what, you know, anything that you can imagine happens. I mean, why would, you know, would we lose that person completely? Would they never come back? I mean, the crack epidemic would mean nothing compared to.
Well, in fact, this is, if you've ever read The Dilbert Future, Scott Adams talks about this, and he says that one of the problems with technology is displayed in the TV show Star Trek: The Next Generation, and it's the holodeck.
Yeah.
Because he says the holodeck will be the last thing humanity invents. Because once we invent the holodeck, we will lose all motivation to ever do anything else because we'll all be in there, yeah, living out whatever that fantasy is. And for a lot of guys, it's going to be, you know, what you talked about. In fact, there were even a couple of Star Trek episodes devoted to that. This loser, Barkley,
yeah,
who created a fantasy life for himself on the holodeck. And, you know, in the end, he gets called back into real life because, hey, real life is a lot better. But, you know, I think the bottom line is you see people, they'd rather, you know, watch TV than have to deal with interaction with fellow human beings. Or, you know, there's so many different escapes that people have now that are pale substitutes for the real thing. When you can actually have this, you know, as far as your nervous system is concerned, this exact life, this sex fantasy or whatever the fantasy is, you know, I can't imagine that a lot of people won't just
disappear.
Opt out of reality, I guess, would be the.
And you know, and it doesn't have to be just sex. I mean, but sex would be a huge part of it. But I mean, like, you know, when you're tired of that, you go drive a NASCAR. You know, and you know, do exciting things all the time instead of your dull, boring life that you have in the real world. You know. And, yeah, I think there's a fair chance that you lose. Maybe that's what happened to E.T., you know? I mean, they enter these virtual reality worlds that are just so much more exciting, and they lose interest in doing anything else.
Well, Harvey in the chat room says maybe robot sex is what will stop wars.
Yeah.
You know, and
How so? I wish Harvey would call in and explain.
Well, because people will be so busy with that they won't. I mean, I'm answering for him, but I would think the way it would stop, you know, in Scott Adams' mind, the way it would stop all human progress just by the fact that we get so busy with our sex fantasies in the holodeck that we don't have time for wars anymore.
I guess so. Yeah. Well,
I think two things will happen first. One, there'll be a phase where there'll be sort of a more powerful social stigma than is attached to almost anything for people to actually admit that they were having sex with robots. Nobody's gonna admit to that.
Well, I think that it doesn't
matter. Sales figures will tell the tale.
Yeah,
they'll be there. It'll be happening. Just nobody's gonna admit it.
Yeah.
Well, I think that you know, robot sex and virtual reality sex will be the equivalent of pornography. And, you know, yeah.
Well, it'll be an alternative lifestyle, you know, much the same as the way homosexuality has come to be accepted as a alternative lifestyle. I think that, you know, at first it'll be, you know, only the weirdos will be doing it, and then it'll become more accepted probably. But anyway.
Yeah, I think that the stigma won't stop the thing from happening. That's
there,
for sure.
That's right.
That's right. Just,
you know,
like,
I think,
you know,
there's a lot more people using porn, particularly on the web, than there are people comfortable about the fact that they do.
Absolutely.
Or feel stigmatized if it was known that they do.
Yeah.
Well, you, as a marketing guy, you've certainly seen the stories about how the VCR achieved, market penetration because of the presence of certain videotapes, and Deep Throat was one of them that drove the adoption of the technology. Nobody admitted that, but the sales numbers didn't lie.
All of a sudden, the adult theaters shut down. Because
right.
Nobody's going to go,
and
you
then,
know, if you can have it, if you can watch that at home, then why go to a grubby theater with some, you know, weirdo on the next aisle over? You know, I mean, you just basically shut that industry down.
Right.
And the second thing that will happen is that there will be people who, for whatever reasons, and I suspect they'll be intellectual more than anything else, will say, yeah, give me the pill that, much like the pill that allows me to learn Russian or turns on some other part of my brain and then turns it off, give me the one that turns that part of my brain on and then give me the one that turns that part of my brain off so I can get some work done. My God, I can't
absolutely
be doing this all the
that,
time.
You know what? That was the one I was going to mention. Greg Egan talks about that in his fiction, the idea of people in the future who, in fact, the future, if we do end up with the holodeck grinding all progress to a halt, the future will belong to these people who decide, we're going to opt out from sex. That in his fictional description of it, they go the whole route. I mean, they don't have external sexual characteristics. You don't use either masculine or feminine pronouns to refer to the, to these people, and sex is just no longer part of their makeup. It's not part of them genetically. It's not part of who they are or how they react to the world. And they've made this choice for the reason that you're talking about there, Michael. Not only to avoid the temptation of spending your whole life in the holodeck necessarily, but just because they look at it and they go, well, this is, you know, there's a certain amount of pleasure associated with this, but it's just this huge baggage that that we don't need anymore. The species can reproduce itself by other means now, and we've decided to step away from that, and therefore we will no longer be sexual beings.
And in Greg Egan's mythos, what's the procreation channel?
Oh, well, there's, you know, this is a far kind of post-singularity future. There's lots of means of making people the
cloning
most
or
people
whatever,
don't
yeah.
In the biological substrate. Most of them are in silicon, so.
Yeah.
But even in the VR world in silicon, they choose not to be human in that sense. They choose to be asexual.
Well, you know, in a way, and Kurzweil has said this, that sexual act has been, taken away from procreation anyway, but various forms of birth control. I mean, we don't find it as a species. We don't find it a burden. most people don't. That those desires, and so we hang on to the sexual act, even if we have no intention to ever have a child in our lifetime. So.
Right. It's hardwired in. I mean, that's a thing, like food, like sleep. I mean, it's something that that we seek as animals, right? Not even as human beings. I mean, it's something that as biological entities on this planet that we want, and
so
that can get channeled in all kinds of different directions when we're no longer strictly speaking biological entities. That's the interesting thing.
So in the in recognition of the fact that today is Aubrey Gray's birthday, happy birthday to Dr. DeGray.
Happy birthday, Aubrey.
Absolutely.
I would also point out that I think the socially, it's going to be a whole different animal in this area of organization and civilization when life expectancy is anywhere close to the kinds of numbers Aubrey's talking about, because you say, yeah, you know, I was 23, we got married until death do us part and all that stuff, and then you live to be 1,023, that's a different bargain than most people sign up for.
Yeah, well, of course, a lot of marriages, even with life lasting as long as they do now, don't last. So,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, fewer and fewer marriages are going the distance even now.
See, I think it'll be the opposite effect, you know. I think a lot of people get divorced because they go, hey, clock's ticking. My life's running out here. I better, if I want a shot at life, you know, I better end this and get on to the next thing. If you think you're going to live, you know, hundreds of years indefinitely, maybe you don't feel that urge. It might actually make marriage last longer. In fact, I think a lot of things will last longer. Careers will last longer. I think a lot of things will be extended because people will live longer rather than.
So you're suggesting that we won't buy our Porsches when we're 45 anymore.
No, we'll get them like when we're 300.
Yeah.
High prices.
have your midlife crisis then.
Okay, well, I think it's just about time for us to wrap it up. Any last parting shots on weird futures from either of you guys?
Well, in the chat room, Matt Doing had this point. He says, I think there'll be a point when someone could choose to totally replace motivations based on evolutionary psychological motivations with conscious, rational ones. And that's pretty much what you said.
That is what Egan is talking about in the story. And you know, on the one hand, I totally buy into that, and on the other hand, it's like, but I wouldn't do it, you know. So it's it's an interesting paradox about.
Well, you know, you could try on, you know, if we're talking virtual reality worlds, you could try on that persona before you committed to it, couldn't you?
That's true.
You could experience, you know, what it would be like to, you know, be that sexless entity or whatever, and see if that's the way you really wanted to live. But anyway.
Yeah, you could also go back to being what you are, or you could try being the other sex, or you could just alternate between all three of those things. In virtual reality, you
do it all, I guess. But
possibilities are limitless.
Wow.
And that is a truly weird future, I think, on which we can close.
There you go.
Our all music right,
well,
tonight.
Go.
We have got a great piece of music tonight. This is something that I think that, once y'all hear it, y'all are going to want to go and download the stereo version, and put it on your iPods. This is Porter Block is the artist, and the song is Second Wind.
Second Wind by Porter Block.
That's right.
All right, well, we'll be looking forward to that, and I guess you'll have the show notes up for us?
Yeah, and as usual, I'll probably have some show notes up in a couple of hours, but the polished and finished version of the show notes will probably be a day coming. So
listeners, keep checking back on the show notes. A lot of interesting things show up over time, like we listen to the show and realize we made mistakes, and we put those up there. And stuff. So all
right.
Kinds of great stuff shows up. All right, well, Stephen, Michael, great show. Thank you both for being with us this evening.
All right.
I would like
to thanks.
Thank our friends in the chat room for their contribution, and for all our listeners, we look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about legal and ethical issues related to animals, and we're talking about the evolution of ethics. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 347-215-8972. Now, let's talk about the practical implications a little bit around relinquishing meat. You know, we had this discussion a few weeks ago about relinquishing technology and or choosing not to adopt technology. Here we've got something kind of orthogonal to that, the idea of I'm going to step away from a practice that basically much of humanity has followed throughout most of human history. There are also cultures that have incorporated vegetarianism for a long period of time. You look at India and the Hindu traditions there. They've been vegetarian for a long time. But by and large, meat eating is something that human beings have been doing for a long time. So what are the implications around deciding you're not going to eat meat anymore? And Stephen, I think related to one of your blog posts earlier this week, I think there's some just serious logistical or practical issues.
Well, yeah, because what I'm doing, Phil, is it's a combination exercise program and low carb diet. Okay, and it's being very successful for me. I mean, the weight's dropping off pretty rapidly, I'm glad to report. And
good for you.
Feeling much better, and so you know, all around it seems to be working, and I'm glad for it. But I'm going to tell you something about a low carb diet. I suppose nothing's impossible, but if you're going to do a low carb diet, you better be ready to eat some serious, you know, stuff with faces. You know what I'm saying? You're going to be downing, you know, I suppose you could still do it with Phil's limitations, Michael. I suppose you could manage a low carb diet eating fish and chicken, but I've not put that limitation on myself with this diet.
You would get pretty tired of fish and chicken.
I probably would, and so I eat a lot of red meat as well as part of this.
In fact, let me tell you that I bought that same book, TNT, right around Christmas time.
Oh, okay. I didn't know.
Sort of was looking at going on that right around the new year. And with my particular dietary limitations, I could not make that work.
Yeah, it would be hard. I mean, to the point of near impossibility if you were going to be a complete vegetarian.
Yeah.
And I think that if you're going to be a complete vegetarian and not eat chicken or fish either, you'd make it probably 3 weeks into the diet, and then you would collapse because, again, you are
That would be a bad thing, just so we're clear, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and when I'm saying collapse, I mean quite literally, you would fall down, and then, you know, somebody would have to come check your pulse because what you're doing is a very, very serious and heavy-duty workout routine involving heavy lifting of weights, not just getting in there and screwing around. You really get serious about it, and I mean you're starved, and you know you and that, so you have to fill that with something, and meat is a huge part of a low carb diet, and I believe that one of the reasons this thing works so well is because we as humans are adapted to a meat heavy diet, and getting away from that is part of the, and eating more carbohydrate and things like that is part of the problem with the obesity epidemic in this country.
Well, I think for sure we evolved eating protein and fat and complex carbs.
Absolutely.
You know, we dig up roots and leaves and things, and we eat those. You know, you get some carbs out of it.
You're not going to get fat eating that, are you?
Right. There were no Krispy Kremes out there in the hunter gatherer.
I think that's fair to say. Yes.
Setting.
No refined sugar at all, very little in the way of, and if you got any kind of grains, it would probably be whole grain for sure.
Yeah.
So
the refined grains and refined sugars, I think, are a relatively recent introduction into our diets, and we're having a hard time dealing with them.
Basically, the fluffy carbs.
Yep, the fluffy carbs, all the yummy stuff. Circus peanuts comes to mind.
I'm a product of the modern era. I am a fluffy carb kind of guy.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I am as well, and I became a very fluffy guy as a result, and now I'm trying to reverse that. So that's what it's all about. So I guess my point is, it'd be very difficult to do that. And so yeah, I'm looking forward to the VAT meat as well, so that I can be thin and feel good about myself too.
I guess you should try it for a week. You know, that'd be a great thing to blog about.
Okay.
You know, don't go vegan, but like just do the like whey protein, eggs and cheese, right? You're just eating omelets and whey protein for a week. Now, and then Stephen ends up in the hospital, and it's because I had this great idea. But you know, you could do it. It's just there wouldn't be much variety, and it would be awfully.
I'd get tired of that pretty quick. How about I go with your dietary limitations for a week and report back next week? No red meat.
Some good seafood down there in Louisiana.
I can get by with seafood and chicken probably. I'll give it a week and report back to you next week how I did with no mammals in the diet.
So. Okay, now, but having said all this, so we'll try this experiment this week and we'll see how that goes. And by the way, congrats and best of luck on the program overall. But what is your thinking in terms of the overall ethical dimension? Your current dietary situation notwithstanding, do you think that we are heading in the direction I'm talking about, or do you think that's off base?
Well, you know, there are other forecasters of the future that have thought we might go the other way. You know, I mean, there was a certain movie a little while back, a dystopian view of the future that thought that. Instead of becoming more ethical about what we eat, we might become less if we're hungry enough. So, anyway.
You got to tell them Silent Breed is people!
And, you know, hopefully it won't go that direction.
Sorry, I talked over that a little bit.
Hey, this is worth repeating.
Yeah, please, one more time.
You got to tell them Silent Breed is people!
Now that is a truly dystopian future, and that is exactly what that's exactly right. That would be our ethics going the other way.
Yeah, and you know where we were forced by circumstances to, you know, get a little bit more liberal in what we eat. Yeah, you know, sure they're people, but they're dead, and you know, whatever.
Yeah, they're dead, and we're out of resources. Therefore, we have to feed the remaining population. Therefore, I mean that was the actual. By the way, that's big spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen the movie. They're eating people. Okay.
So picture the political leader in the moment where they make the conscious decision: we choose to make people food.
Well, yeah.
I mean, how do you sell
that
deal?
Go over as big.
Well,
we choose to go to the moon.
It doesn't ring as you know. It just sounds so much better to choose to go to the moon, doesn't it?
I cannot put those two together. I want to mention before we lose the thread that was the voice, of course, of Charlton Heston, who passed away last week, and we failed to mention it on last week's program, and so we wanted to definitely make sure we had a small tribute to him this week. Charlton Heston, great 20th century actor, played in all the Bible epics and was in at least three major dystopian science fiction films of the 70s that I can think of. He was in Planet of the Apes, Soylent Green, and Omega Man.
Yeah.
Plus, he was big in the disaster films, too. So he was kind of a Renaissance man.
He was a very dramatic individual.
There's a little watched Western that he did that was just great. Will Penny.
Will Penny is... You know what? That's my dad's favorite movie.
It's an awesome
wow.
movie. Yeah. So, he was an all-around kind of actor and a great man. And you know, whether you believe in, you know, a son, however you feel about his politics in his later years, I think that most people who knew him thought he was a great guy. So.
Yeah, and he will be missed.
Best to his family.
I did want to mention that. Did you guys happen to see the remake? The abomination remake of Planet of the Apes with Mark Wahlberg.
I've seen part of it. I
guess not.
Phil. Watch it all the way through.
Charlton Heston has a cameo in that as an old chimp, and he actually reprises his damn them all to hell line from the end of Planet of the Apes. It's certainly the only reason that you would want to see that movie. But what was great about that is that occurred he was already ill by then, but
And it actually had an anti-gun message, which is pretty interesting.
Well, it was sort of an anti-gun line there. Of course, it's a chimp talking, obviously it's not really Charlton Heston's views on these things necessarily that you're hearing.
And even the NRA is not advocating the arming of chimps.
No.
True.
That's an excellent.
It's a human right, yes.
But the thing that kind of bothered me a little bit last week on all the coverage, it all seemed like Charlton Heston was this political figure, which he was, and it was very important to him, and I don't mean to diminish that. But to me, I will always remember him as just this great guy in all these great movies. And I don't want people to lose sight of that. And he really just sort of wrapped it up very nicely, appearing in that brief scene in that remake of Planet of the Apes, where he was kind of riffing on himself, both on the big dramatic line from the end of Planet of the Apes and on his stance as a political figure. So,
well, yeah, it doesn't talk to the ethics of the future, although I can't help but say, you know, there are films that get remade, and even if they're remade well, I scratch my head and say, why? Why? Was the team just so enamored of the original Planet of the Apes and so convinced that now the filmmaking technology had advanced, the moment was right, we have to redo this?
My thought on remakes is, if you can't make it better, don't. You know, that's kind of all that. And there have been a few remakes that are better. Any jump to y'all's mind of remakes that actually were better than the originals?
Well, if you want to talk TV shows, we got Battlestar Galactica, clearly.
Yeah, there you go. That's a great example.
I did want to say in defense, since I called it an abomination, I do want to say in defense of the remake of Planet of the Apes that the ape makeup was outstanding.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that really came along over the decades. So,
okay, so that's a reason to maybe redo it. But I caught the tail end of the remake of King Kong recently, the Jack
Peter
Black
Jackson,
version. Yeah, and I was like, I get that Peter Jackson, nobody's going to tell Peter Jackson no after the success of the trilogy, but come on, somebody's got to pull him aside and say, why are we doing this?
That was a beautiful movie, though, in the sense that what you saw on the screen was absolutely mind-blowing.
Yes, and so what?
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I don't know.
Eye candy.
The thing is, they'll make movies out of anything, right? They make them out of old TV shows. They make them out of video games. They'd make them out of a cereal box. So naturally, they're going to remake old movies. I mean, you know, that's just one of the many things that they can draw on. They're going to make a movie out of anything they can think of that they might be able to make a movie out of.
Well, the newest King Kong is better than the 70s King Kong.
Here's one they should remake, or they should make a movie out of, a comic book called Mr. X. And the basic premise of Mr. X is that the Mr. X character was an architect. He was a designer. He was a master planner. And he master designed the perfect city. And it was going to be sort of a utopian city because by the very nature of its design. And towards the end of the project got corrupted. And he was exiled and ran for his life, basically, because the people that took over the project corrupted everything about the design just enough to basically make not only anti-utopian, but it made everybody paranoid and nobody could sleep, and it was just this wacky city. Great comic book. There's a movie they should make, but nobody's going to make Mr. X into a movie.
Well, if somebody, if Dark Horse or somebody gets a hold of Mr. X, does a new series of Mr. X, it's popular. Hey, comics are one of the things they use for movies, so push it.
Well,
man. You got to push it.
You know, I just had gotten into the idea of just a little bit with the Charlton Heston quote that, you know, sometimes our ethics are based on what we're able to do.
Okay, hold that thought, because what I want to say before you say that
is
this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and we're just getting to the good stuff. Stephen has introduced the main part of the topic of ethics that I wanted to talk about, and if you'd like to join that conversation, you could join us at 347-215-8972. Sorry to interrupt you, Stephen. Go ahead with that.
No problem at all. And we've recently, there's an article, and I'll have it in the show notes, about how, sometimes societies, they reach a certain level of complexity, and then they're doomed to collapse because of over-complexity, hyper-specialization or whatever. Obviously, if, you know, if society collapses, a lot of things that are that we consider, you know, good ethics today could, you know, I mean, we're not gonna stop eating meat if society collapses. I think we're more likely to stop eating meat when a meat substitute becomes available because society continues to advance. And so our ability to have advancing ethics, I think, correlates with with technological advancement.
Let me read that from Michael Anisimov. He was writing on this exact subject just a few days ago, and he writes that everyone will be a vegan soon, if for nothing else, that in vitro meat will be better and cheaper. When we're no longer compelled to mass murder animals in factory farms, many people will stand up and say, well, we knew it was wrong all along.
Yeah.
Amazing how morally sophisticated people can get when practical alternatives to the immoral behavior emerge. And then he says, in parens, I'm guilty of this as much as anyone. And in fact,
it's almost a cynical way of looking at humanity, isn't it? But in some ways, it's just saying, you know, we're very, very pragmatic about what we consider to be right and wrong.
I think it's I think Michael is spot on, and I think it's an acknowledgement of the evolutionary pressure that says, look, we didn't eat meat because we have a grudge against cows.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, hey, let's go make war on all the other creatures with faces. That wasn't really the motivation. Although, I mean, the motivation.
The growling stomach was the motivation.
Yeah. And it was like, hey, I think there's some food over there. It's in the form of a large animal. Let's hunt it down and eat it.
You know, we hunted the cave bear to extinction, and it was not because, imagine going up against
so damn good.
Yeah. Well, imagine going up against a cave bear with a spear, you know, and how dangerous that was, you know, hunting would have been in those days, and yet they were willing to do it because they had to do it.
They had to do it to live, to
yeah.
survive. I mean,
and I think,
against it, or they want some cave bear burritos to get them through the winter, right?
I'm reminded of a documentary film that I think made the rounds. Well, let's see, it would be approximately 30 years ago when I was in 10th grade. 20 years ago. Wait a minute, I can't do the math. It was a long time ago when I was in 10th grade. And
that would have been a long time ago.
It was, but it was a documentary. It wasn't really happening at the time. I'm going to tell what happened in the documentary. That wasn't happening in my life. That was in a film, and I saw it in a classroom. But in the film, it's the village that basically hunts an elephant. And it's the elephant hunt, and they're chasing this elephant with spears and rocks and, like, you know, little vine made into rope snares. And after an hour of them chasing the elephant, they finally get the elephant, and they're, you know, maybe 4 miles from the village by the time they bring the thing down. And everybody in the village comes out, and the whole village basically just picks up camp and moves to where the elephant carcass is for several days, because now they have to basically harvest this kill. And at the end of the film, they make the point that the village in that mode produces approximately 9 days worth of food by capturing an elephant for the entire village. It took them 13 days on average to catch an elephant.
Wow.
I'm like,
so
okay,
they were running at a deficit.
That's right. I'm like, you know, the hunter-gatherer thing, the gatherer part of that society really is the reason that society, that village life, can survive at all. In
right.
fact, the only reason they go hunt is because they always have and they just learned it, or because they're just like, hey, let's go kill that elephant. We can eat it, but it has no real mathematical logic to it.
Well, and don't you know that an elephant would taste good after eating, like, herbs,
roots and berries and
roots.
Twigs and yeah.
I'm not saying I wouldn't eat the thing. I would, but I'm just saying that
add a little elephant
pressure,
to the root and berry.
Although I
got to
say, you put me in that world, and I think I would have invented vegetarianism. Man, I don't want to have to go try to kill an elephant or a cow, right? I would have started a whole thing. Oh man, we shouldn't kill animals. This is just wrong.
I would have been thinking we should.
You would
kill
have the village wise man,
it,
Phil. You would have a lot of
capture some breeding pairs, and we should farm them. Come on.
Well, yeah. See,
you would have invented riding in the wheel. That would have been your kind of.
I don't know. I'm not so sure.
Well, knowing what you know now,
that our relationships to animals change, to each other changes, and to the world as a whole changes, as our capabilities increase. I really think that technology enables us to broaden our ethical standards. That's really, I think, the lesson, I think that's what we're seeing at work when we see something like, hey, we're going to start producing meat in vitro and not killing animals. I think that is just one of many reflections of a principle that's played itself out over and over again. Last week we were talking about the Civil War, and I've written on the blog before that I think that the Civil War was all about technology. I think that that you had two halves of the country that had gotten a little bit apart from each other in terms of what they were doing with technology. The North was industrialized and didn't need slave labor in order to achieve what they were doing. The Confederate States were still agrarian and very much saw it as necessary for them to have slavery in order to maintain their economic viability. So you have the North, who is technologically advanced beyond that, who can now take an ethical stance and say, this is wrong. You know, it's wrong for them because...
Which, of course, it was.
Well,
but they had the ability to say that. They had
not to say that it was anything other than wrong. It clearly it was wrong. But technology enabled them to get to the point where they could say it. Or you see that when we recognize that we need to protect the environment.
Right.
And that we need to take care of, you know, vast tracts of, you know, wilderness to make sure that species are protected and things like that.
I think there's a great point to be made there, Phil, because, you know, a lot of green people in the, you know, activists of various flavors will generally point to, you know, like the United States and other developed countries and wag their fingers at us. But, I mean, you want to go someplace where the environment is being raped. Try the developing world or the undeveloped world. You know,
right. And why are they not as worried about the environment as we are?
Well, because they can't be. They can't afford to be.
Exactly.
If you're starving to death, and you know that slashing and burning this rainforest over here, you know, would lead to you know, money in this way or that way, then you're going to do it. And, you know, it's only later once you've, you know, you've got an established civilization that you can afford to begin thinking about these other concerns.
Well, 2 points, and one definitely more serious than the other. But just so you're clear, when you're talking about green people, and very green people, human flavors, we're talking about ecologically sensitive humans, not the Soylent Green type.
Right.
Point two.
Green giant. Okay.
Point two, that... I think the broader point, perhaps, is that there's a solid argument to be made that all ethics, now and in the future, are contextual. And the classic kill or be killed example that justifies taking life or even taking human life, you know, even beyond that, the extension to a civilization saying, well, yeah, but if we don't do X, Y, or Z, we don't see how we can sustain our population. We can't produce enough food to feed ourselves. And if we do X, Y, Z, and it results in some environmental harm that we can't afford to see our way through yet, the ethics of the situation become contextual, and it becomes a temporal and a complicated thing. It's not so easy to just say, yeah, we shouldn't let the developing world have cars like we have because we know that we can't afford the carbon footprint that's going to come with it. Well, that's ethically.
That's the kind of a harsh thing to tell the guy that's sitting in India and has never had a chance to own a car.
That's a tough sale.
Yeah, here we are sitting in our Lexus telling him he can't have a car.
We choose to walk because it's the right thing to do. I mean, I don't think you sell that deal that way.
No.
I think ethics are contextual, but I definitely think that the trend is that we extend our ethical concerns, that technology has allowed us to have like a broader scope of what we consider to be behavior that falls within a ethical purview than we used to have.
Because
I agree
we used to, or because we're allowed to, or we can afford to?
Because we can afford to. Because
I think that's exactly right.
Because we're capable of doing it. But it's very interesting that once you have the capability, it seems that you go in that direction, that you say, I will no longer entreat, I will no longer consider it right ever to treat human beings simply as a means to an end, right? That's slavery, right?
Right.
At some point we have to say that there is a level of individual dignity that lies within a human being that has to be respected no matter what. Or a few years later you take the stand and you say, well, you can't mistreat animals. You know, I'm now taking the stand that you can't treat animals just as a means to an end. You know, maybe we're still using them to some extent, but we're not just
we're not engaging in dogfighting and
there you go.
And,
right.
Yeah.
And the same applies to the planet as a whole.
Yeah.
Where we say at some point we thought we could just use it as a means to an end, and we still have to use it. And this is where quote from the Fountainhead comes to mind. There's a scene in the Fountainhead. Howard Roark is out in the it's early in the book. For those who haven't read Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, this isn't really a spoiler or anything, but he's getting ready to take a swim in the rock quarry, and he's just looking around, and everywhere he looks, he sees nature that he can tame and do something useful with, because right now it's all just lying there fallow and waiting for him to do something with it. And if you've read Atlas Shrugged, the character Dagny Taggart, I believe is her name, echoes some of those same kind of ideas when she basically says, there's either, you know, technology and there's all the great things that human beings build, or there's weeds, right? that whole attitude that nature is just there for us to exploit, for us to do whatever we want to with, and we've really moved away from that idea. We don't have that idea anymore. You know, we still recognize that we have to interact with nature, and we have to do things with nature to get where we need to go, but we can't just treat it as a means to an end. Our ethics have expanded to incorporate nature, to incorporate animals in ways that they didn't before.
I think the right idea is to, you know, we're to be good stewards, I mean, of what we have, and to use it as we need to use it, but to allow nature to be nature and not just trounce it because we can, you know.
Exactly. And, you know, we never even got to the topic of artificial intelligence, but I see now that we're already at the point we ought to start talking about what the music is.
Yeah, yeah. Sunday Dogs is the name of the band, and the song is Sapien. And it has seen as a very cynical song about human intelligence. So we don't all, you know, just because we play it doesn't mean we agree with it. It's rockin' tune, though.
So we got a little bit of cynicism about human intelligence as we close out our discussion on the future of ethics. But I think we'll have to revisit this one because it feels
there's
like
a lot here, isn't there?
Yeah, we miss some of it. I'm sorry. What was the name of the song again?
Sapien.
Sapien, and we'll have links to that and all the show notes.
Absolutely, and so if you want to hear it, when we play it on the show, it's mono. You get to hear it in stereo if you'll come to the show notes. And we'll have links to everything else we've talked about. And so, of course, that's at The Speculist.
Speculist.com. All right. Well, thank you very much, Stephen. And thank you, Michael.
Ciao.
And thank you to our friends in the chat room and to everyone who was listening. We look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.
I can harvest that on which